Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dance Talks. My guest today is Jack Riccobono, a very prominent and interesting filmmaker whose work, it's said in the New York Times and other places, explores the hidden subcultures in our country, and I think also around the world on several of the pieces you've done. One of the reasons I wanted him on the podcast is his connection with Long Island and then now Montauk, where he has done filming and may do more filming. But before I get to that, let me ask you some questions about your work. You kind of jumped out with a film you made called The Seventh Fire at the Berlin Film Festival. Tell us about how that came to be and how you thought to begin that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Dan. Well, The Seventh Fire is a Verite documentary feature that I made that followed two Native American men on the Ojibwe reservation in northern Minnesota and looked at the influence of gang culture on these rural reservations and how it impacted these two men's lives. So the main subject of that film was named Rob Brown. And, you know, he had gone through 36 foster families as a child, had been in and out of prison four times when I met him. And he had a really amazing ability to sort of reflect on that life and that experience that he had had. And was at a pivotal turning point, I think, in his life when I met him, and was able to sort of speak about how these cycles of trauma and these broken systems, you know, the foster care system, the prison system, had impacted his life. So I followed him for about 2.5 years, and at the same time followed another subject named Kevin Findeay, who was 17 years old when I met him, and was almost, you know, entering kind of this cycle of violence and incarceration that Rob had lived with, you know, for his whole life. So between the two of them, the film really tries to look at, you know, how these bigger social systems break down and impact people on the individual level, on the personal level. So it was a very challenging film to make, as my subjects were involved in criminal activity at different points. They were in some danger themselves at different points, and it's a pretty insular community. So it took a lot of trust building to be able to gain access and to do their stories justice.
Where did you grow up and how did you get interested in being a filmmaker?
I grew up in New York City, and I guess when I was a senior in high school, I had an opportunity to do an internship and get some credit in high school for, you know, working at a business. And I ended up interning at Killer Films, and this was in 1998. And that's, you know, the film company run by Christine Vachon and Pam Koffler, who are kind of legendary independent film producers. And so it was kind of, you know, just lucky timing at that point. The independent film scene in New York City was very vibrant. And, you know, they were famous for working with filmmakers like Todd Haynes and Todd Solondz. And they were actually finishing Boys Don't Cry when I was there. And as an intern, they at that point, they actually had an open script submission policy, which is kind of crazy to imagine in today's world. But back then, literally anyone could just mail them a script and it would go into their system of coverage. So the interns, you know, were in charge of doing that first read and writing up treatment, writing up coverage of the script. And they had this crazy filing system where they would keep, you know, all of these paper copies of all these scripts. And so that was really my first entry point into the business, was being able to sort of see how these two amazing producers were able to get these really challenging and artistic projects made.
Was this by accident, or did you love filmmaking and learn about it earlier when you were growing up as a kid?
I loved movies. I mean, my parents loved movies so much that when we were little, if they were going to go see like an R-rated or foreign film or something, they would actually trade off. So like one of us would watch us, then they would race home so that the other one could then get to the late show of the same movie. So, you know, I mean, we were very much a film going family. And
What would your parents do? What was their work?
So my father also grew up in New York in Astoria, and he worked for the Board of Education for about 30 years, ultimately becoming the superintendent of a school district in East New York, Brooklyn. And my mother's originally from Missouri, but she went to Bard College and then ended up in New York City where they met. And, you know, certainly a dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker at this point, and worked as an artist's assistant and, you know, is definitely artistically inclined. So, yeah, that's.
I know that you made a film that's currently being shown over and over that's also very well received, which was called Amityville, An Origin Story. And that's a big Long Island story. Talk a little bit about how you decided to do that story. Why?
Yeah, well, Amityville, An Origin Story is a four-part docuseries that's on MGM Plus. And this was the first time that I had worked on a limited series. So it was a very different kind of process. The project came to me after it had been sold to the network and they were looking for a showrunner, a director to sort of take it over and go make it. And so when I first learned about it, I didn't know that much about Amityville, which is, of course, one of the legendary Long Island stories and horror stories. You know, I guess I'd heard about sort of the Ryan Reynolds remake of it and something about the original film, you know, which came out in 1979 and starred Margot Kidder and James Brolin. And so I sort of had, you know, a little time to prepare to sort of pitch myself for this job. And I just, you know, I watched a bunch of the movies, I read the book and sort of immersed myself in it. And I guess what drew me to it is that there are these different layers to this story. It's really about two different families and two different pivotal events. The first being the Lutz family that moved into this house in Amityville, Long Island in 1975, and about a month later fled the house, reporting all of these strange, unexplained experiences that they had inside the house that drove them from the house. And the other family was the DeFeo family, which a year before the Lutzes moved into that same house had been found murdered in the house, and six out of seven family members shot to death in their beds under mysterious circumstances in 1974.
Was that ever solved?
Well, that depends on who you talk to, Dan. but I think, you know, this story involves sort of this true crime element with the DeFeo family murders, and that family had connections to the mafia. And of course, a mass murder like that in 1974 in an affluent Long Island suburb was quite a strange and crazy story. Walter Cronkite covered it twice. So it was national news when that happened. And what ended up transpiring was that the eldest son, Ronnie, who was 23 at the time, also known as Butch, was ultimately convicted of murdering his entire family, including his sisters and brothers, the youngest victim being as young as nine, and his parents. So it was, you know, a terrible mass murder. But the police seemed to to sort of rush to judgment on who was responsible. They pinned the crime on Ronnie very quickly. And there were a number of questions left unanswered by the criminal investigation that sort of left the door open, I think, for what was to come, which was basically then a paranormal and horror story that kind of drafted off of this really horrific murder. And I think the murders, you know, gave what the Lutzes said happened to them, this kind of dark energy that just completely exploded in the 1970s and became this huge cultural phenomenon.
What were some of their paranormal experiences in that house?
Well, so they reported a number of things. Kathy Lutz reported that she felt like her hand had been touched when she was in the kitchen by something that she couldn't explain. They reported experience of levitating off of the bed. They said that the house would have these massive changes in temperature and that there were strange substances leaking from the walls, from the locks of the doors, and black substance found in the toilets that they could not explain, that they found cloven hoof prints in the snow, and that their youngest daughter, Missy, had this imaginary friend who they thought was a demonic pig. So there was a lot of different things which sound pretty ridiculous when you go through them. But the thing about the Lutzes is that they had the ability to talk about these experiences in a very kind of sober and subdued way. And they won a lot of people over. You know, they didn't come across as kind of whack jobs. And so people believed what they said. And when the local news got a hold of it, it sort of snowballed. They invited Ed and Lorraine Warren, who were very famous paranormal investigators of the time in the 70s. It's who the Conjuring horror series is based off of, their case files, the Warrens. They invited them in to do a seance inside the house just a few weeks after they fled. And that was covered by local news. And it just snowballed into this huge story, which led to a best-selling book and then a movie.
So your piece is now on MSNBC to be seen?
And it's on MGM Plus, which is a streaming channel that you can get through Amazon or Apple TV Plus.
Let's move to your weekend in Montauk.
Okay.
What brought you out there besides me talking to you at a party?
Well, I guess I had spent some summers with my family on Shelter Island the last couple of years. And then this summer, we decided to rent a place in the Springs. And so we were out there for a month. So it was the longest period that I'd sort of really been out in the Hamptons area. And we did a fishing trip from Montauk. And in talking with you, I heard about Camp Hero and the conspiracy theories swirling around what happened there. So I did do a field trip with my sons to check out some bunkers in the woods.
did you ever research what the Montauk Project was about?
I looked into it a little bit, yeah. And I mean, I think that Stranger Things, the TV show, had originally been entitled The Montauk Project when that pilot was first circulating. And so I think that's, you know, some of what's in that show is, I think, inspired by what they said happened at Camp Hero, which, from what I understand, there is the idea that some kind of psychological weapons were perhaps experimented with and developed in Camp Hero. Is that right?
So it was military and then secret. And after the war, World War II, and there are these underground tunnels that were built at Camp Hero for storing ammunition, which are now vacant. The military did not clean up its place there, so it was left as a mess, and people started wandering around in it over the barbed wire and so forth. And then this very famous story from I think written by some people who were out of their minds. But it was something that circulated for a long, long time. And what else have you been toying with about something that might take up time in the future? Have you got anything else now on your plate?
I have a few things. I just finished a screenplay that I would like to make next, a narrative feature that's a crime story set in New York City in 2014. And then there's a number of doc series that I've been developing. And then I've also just recently licensed the life rights to Hans Holzer, who is the godfather of the paranormal and wrote the seminal book Ghost Hunter in 1963 that helped set off the paranormal investigation craze that still continues to this day. So he's a fascinating figure, an Austrian Jew born in 1920 who emigrated in 1938 and had a journalism background, but also had a long-standing fascination with ghosts. And what's interesting about him, he actually couldn't stand Ed and Lorraine Warren because they were demonologists and came from a kind of religious background, whereas he saw himself as coming from a science background and being able to kind of blend science with paranormal investigation in what he called the Holzer method. So yeah, I'm about to sort of launch into research and development of a script around his life also.
What do you like to do here when you come out for the summer? What are some of your, why do you love this place if you do, other than the traffic?
Yeah.
Everybody.
I mean, I growing up in New York City, I didn't come out there regularly, but I mean, through the years I've come out quite a few times. And just on this most recent visit, we were able to go to the Jackson Krasner house, and they talked about sort of the light and about how many artists have been drawn to the area. And the salt marshes, I think, are just really beautiful. And we made a point to try to go almost every sunset to go see the sunset at the beach. And it's just, I think it's just a very special place, the landscape and how windswept it is. And you just feel the ocean, wherever you are.
Yes, that's very true. I want to thank you for being on the podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed it.
Thanks very much, Dan. Appreciate you having me. And it was great to talk with you.
Sure. Bye-bye.